This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the morning shower to brushing and flossing, doing the laundry, loading the dishwasher, our daily routines are marked by efforts to avoid germs. While it's fairly obvious why we do it, the cumulative effect of germ avoidance is less apparent. A group of evolutionary biologists propose that such avoidance is extremely significant. In fact, they theorize that cultures across the world have been largely shaped by the struggle to avoid disease. Here with more is Ethan Waters. He wrote about some of those biologists in an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All Your Most Cherished Beliefs, which was published in Pacific Standard. Ethan Waters, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
In the article, you profile the evolutionary biologist Randy Thornhill primarily and his pathogen stress theory. This is a potentially paradigm-shifting theory of human behavior. Can you summarize it for us?
He's really swinging for the fences with this one, for sure. This is the idea that we have psychological mechanisms that bring us to avoid diseases. You know, and as you said, you could see that on a sort of daily basis. But his theory is that these mechanisms over time in culture have an enormous effect on things that we wouldn't necessarily think they would have an effect on, like what sort of government you have, whether you have a group that is interdependent or a group that values independence. And the idea is that certain places in the world, you have higher disease loads. And because of that, you tend to go towards behavior that would, say, favor your in-group or keep outsiders at bay because you would have developed immune resistance to the diseases around you, but maybe not to the ones that over the hill. So you tend to have these sort of social structures that get going under the pressure of disease. And alternatively, in other places where there's a lower disease threat, you have a different set of evolutionary pressures that allow for perhaps more independent thinking, more trade with other people because you don't have those disease loads, which leads to another set of cultural sort of behaviors that have an effect generation after generation that lead to other outcomes, like in Thornhill's theories, democracies in one place, autocratic governments in another place, higher religious displays in certain places, more cultural diversity in some places and less so in other places.
Okay, so that's a big load of things out there. Part of the breakdown that Thornhill does is looks at things regionally, and it seems to me sort of determined by climate. This is something that's been done before. You know, there seems to be more democratically run societies in the northern hemisphere and fewer in the global south. What does climate have to do with this?
Right. So climate, in places where it's warm and wet, you know, traditionally, certainly over time, you've had higher disease loads. So you have the malaria, you have the dengue fever, you have really pernicious and ongoing disease threats. And this is because that certain bugs, you know, need certain climate elements to sort of survive. So in certain places of the world, there's no doubt that traditionally there has been higher disease loads. And the theory is that when that happens, you tend to do a number of things within your culture. You tend to keep outsiders more away. You tend to invest in your in-group more. And that would lead potentially to more sort of patriarchal societies, more traditional societies, societies where custom is really held tightly to. And the idea is that when you move away from those zones, the opposite thing happens.
Mm-hmm. So you become more xenophobic in places where there is, what, a heavier pathogen load? Is that the way he puts it?
Exactly. Where disease is always around you, you tend to invest in your in-group. You tend to marry in. You tend to keep outsiders at bay. And when you do that generation after generation, you tend to create social structures, religions that reinforce this, governments that reinforce this, and social values and behaviors and things that we think are sort of most central to our beliefs about the world. Thornhill believes comes from these disease avoidance behaviors over time.
Well, you know, Ethan, I was just sort of observing myself on a plane about a week ago when someone was sneezing next to me, and this sort of like moment of revulsion and disgust and fear, you know, reeling back, thinking that you might get sick. I understand that on a kind of visceral level. discarding our waste, you know, away from our homes, avoiding sick people, not handling the dead. These are examples that we have actually in the natural world. Where do we find those?
Absolutely. I mean, human cultures have, you know, we have all sorts of ways of avoiding disease, and we tend to think of it as just sort of a natural reaction, and we tend to think of it as not affecting our values about the world. But there's another set of researchers up in British Columbia who've actually done sort of experiments, basically very similar to the one you just had on the plane, where they'll cue people to a disease threat, and then they will ask them questions about whether the government should give money to help immigrants from a foreign country. And after they've been cued with that disease threat, their values tend to shift significantly on that exact topic. People that have been cued to the threat of disease will be more likely to say, well, actually, we shouldn't give money to help those people come from that foreign country. Whereas the people that weren't given the disease condition were more likely to express more liberal values. The reason that the liberal values come about when there's less disease in Thornhill's theory is that the ways we defend against diseases are actually evolutionary kind of costly. To keep outsiders at bay means you're not trading with other people. It means you're not spreading your genetic material in other areas because you're not mating with other people. When that disease threat goes away, the theory goes, you tend to go away from those costly behaviors. You tend to trade more. You tend to marry out groups more. The trade leads to increased wealth. Wealth can lead to increased education. Education can lead to things like, you know, democracies and land ownership and so forth like that. So you have this sort of cycle that goes on in the lower disease regions where you give up these sort of costly ways of keeping diseases at bay.
We're talking about pathogen stress theory, a potentially paradigm-shifting theory that can help explain human behavior and culture and how it developed in certain societies. The idea has been put forward and tested by an evolutionary biologist named Randy Thornhill and one named Corey Fincher. We're speaking with Ethan Waters, who wrote about their work for Pacific Standard Magazine. How does it extend to this idea of, whether or not you're a democratic or a dictatorship type of political structure? What does it mean in terms of religion and belief and personal beliefs?
Well, many of these things like religion can in part be seen as displays of group membership. So the idea behind religion is that if you live in a place where you really need to know who's in my group and who's in that other group, and you need to know that because that other group might have a disease that you haven't developed a resistance to. So there are places in the world where there's really a patchwork of diseases. Even a similar disease will have different enough genetic material from one town to the next that will make that a threat to you, even if you have a resistance to your local disease. So if you live in a place like that, you need a way to display when someone walks down the road towards you, whether that person is in your group or not in your group. And religion, in one level, can be seen as a display of group membership. And so if you need a very, very micro way of understanding who's in your group and who's not, you tend to develop religious displays that are very dramatic, that make it very clear who's in your group and who's not, as with things like dress and cultural customs, dialects, and so on. You develop this patchwork of cultures so that you can tell I'm different from the person just down the road, because you need to know that because of this disease avoidance behavior. That's how the theory goes.
How did they test their hypothesis?
Well, basically, they're dealing with large data sets at this point. So one of the things that they're not doing is basically going and observing this on a very local level. There is data on whether societies are collectivist or individualist. There's data on whether societies are democratic or not. There's data about those religious subgroups and so forth. And they'll take that data set, and then they'll take data sets about disease prevalence and put them together and see if they can make a correlation between higher disease prevalence, say, and patriarchal systems, or higher disease prevalence and high religiosity and so forth. And they're finding this very a significant correlation. Of course, one of the criticisms of the disease of the theory is that correlations that don't actually make causation, and they have gotten some criticism from jumping too quickly from, oh, we have a correlation here, then we must have the cause. There's a remarkable amount of evidence out there on this. It is not just, you know, some graduate student's theory. There's significant research out there, but this is still early days for this theory, and a whole lot more needs to be done in terms of understanding this connection between disease and culture.
Yeah, it does seem like painting with a pretty broad brush. This also, in some ways, could tip into a tricky territory of justifying xenophobia and ethnocentric behavior. How does Fincher and his colleagues address these kind of concerns?
Well, they've dealt, you know, being evolutionary psychologists, they've dealt with this thing before, and it's really a tricky thing for these people because they're looking for the fundamental motivations of human behavior, and that goes to sexual behavior, our values, our governments, and so forth, and they're looking for the evolutionary cues and the psychological mechanisms that might make our behavior understandable. In doing so, people often misread it as saying, oh, then that behavior is justifiable. If it's evolutionary, it must be okay, or we have to behave this way. And I don't think Thornhill and Fincher and none of the evolutionary theorists I've talked to actually make that case, but people hear it that way, which is very unfortunate because I think to understand these behaviors, to understand xenophobia and racism and so forth, we do need to know the psychological mechanisms that underlie them. And even if there are those mechanisms, that doesn't mean that we're locked into behaving that way, and it certainly doesn't justify any behavior. But I think the idea is if we understand this behavior better, we can mitigate it more. And if we understand, for instance, that, you know, health is behind a lowering of racism or lowering of xenophobia, I think we have some really interesting new ways of thinking about if you want to live in a world without xenophobia and racism, what we need to do next.
Ethan Waters, I want to thank you for helping us understand this better today. Thank you.
Oh, a pleasure.
Ethan Waters, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, Men's Journal, Details, Wired, and PRI's This American Life. He wrote an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All of Your Most Cherished Beliefs for Pacific Standard. You'll find a link to read that article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So from culture seeding germs, we're going to go next to a virus straight out of science fiction. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll discuss the recently discovered pithovirus, which has been sealed in the Siberian permafrost for more than 30,000 years. And what happens if all that ice melts? This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 1971 science fiction film The Andromeda Strain exploited human fears about space exploration. In the film, an extraterrestrial virus introduced to Earth mutates and rapidly kills with little distinction.
It's crazy. I didn't know buzzards fly at night.
Buzzards only come when something's dead.
Lando Decker to Cable One. What's happening?
We see bodies. Lots of them.
These people were cut down in mid-stride.
The terrifying Andromeda strain had otherworldly origins, but in recent years, new potentially harmful giant viruses have been discovered all over planet Earth. The recently discovered pithovirus has been sealed in the Siberian permafrost for more than 30,000 years. While this and many other giant viruses are considered harmless to humans, others unearthed by rapidly thawing ice may not be so benign. Here with more is John Timmer, senior science editor at Ars Technica, who wrote about the discovery of the giant pithovirus. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Giant virus does sound so ominous. Is a giant virus very distinct from regular run-of-the-mill virus?
Yeah, in several ways. So to begin with, the giant name comes from the fact that these are actually big enough to be seen with a standard microscope. Normally, to visualize a virus, you need a very fancy high-end electron microscope, but these can be seen with a standard optical one.
Where are some examples of where giant viruses have been found in recent years, and why all the interest in recent years?
Those are two interesting questions. So one of the best examples of the discovery of a giant virus was somebody came into a clinic with an eye infection, and it turned out they were reusing their sterile contact lens cleaning fluid.
Ooh.
And when the lab grew out what was infecting her eye, it was an amoeba. And when they checked the amoeba, it had a virus in it. And when they checked the virus, it had a virus growing in it. So it was an entire little ecosystem growing in this woman's eye because she wasn't being careful with her contact lens cleaner.
Okay, we're all – everyone in the studio is waving their arms and getting icked out by that.
Yes.
Any other places in nature where they may have been discovered, giant viruses?
They found them in the ocean, pretty much anywhere the amoebas can grow, which is in the soil and water. You can find viruses infecting them.
Okay, that second part of the question I asked you, why all of these recent discoveries of giant viruses?
To begin with, nobody really knew what they were looking at. There's a chance somebody actually saw one of these viruses in the microscope back in the 50s and just had no clue it was a virus, assumed something that big was almost certainly a bacteria. So we could have been missing them for decades. This one lab has now specialized in identifying them. It's a group in France that studies these. Because so far the only ones we know about affect amoebas, they basically culture amoebas in different conditions and try to find viruses growing out of them. And they're interesting because they contain a bizarre mixture of genes. One of the viruses actually has over 2,000 genes that we've never seen before. And usually when we study things like bacteria or animals, we find that the genes kind of look familiar because all bacteria are related to each other, all animals are related to each other. And in these viruses, there's thousands of genes we've never seen before. So it's really interesting to try to figure out what these genes do and how they came about through evolution.
Well, let's get to this recent discovery of the pithovirus. How, where was it found?
So the group in this case collaborated with some Russian researchers who used sterile techniques to obtain a sample of permafrost that's been frozen for about 32,000 years. And all they did was grow the amoebas that they know these viruses tend to victimize in with a chunk of the permafrost. And then they checked to see whether the amoebas were growing in a healthy manner. And in fact, these viruses, after they had infect the cells, explode them in order to spread further. And all they had to do was look for exploding cells, and they had a sign that a virus was in action.
So as you explained it, the researchers added a little bit of permafrost to this culture of amoebas. The amoebas just exploded because of this pithovirus. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound very good. I mean, should we be worried about the effects of such an active virus on humans?
No, because amoebas are very evolutionarily distant from us. It's been billions of years since we shared a common ancestor with them. So the viruses that attack them are overwhelmingly unlikely to attack human cells.
You describe the pithovirus as sort of distinct and remarkable compared to other giant viruses. What are some of those distinctions?
There's at least three different families of giant viruses, and the pithovirus is the first member of the third family we've discovered. And it shares some features with the other giant viruses in terms of how it attacks cells and the physical shape of the virus, but its genome is much smaller. It's got fewer genes, it's got less DNA than the other viruses, which is quite unusual.
Well, what does that mean?
It's hard to say what that means. It basically means that there are more lifestyles compatible with being a giant virus than we knew about previously.
So the Arctic ice is melting in so many places, which means that more and more permafrost is being uncovered. And the implications being twofold, more humans moving in, and there's a potential for more ancient giant viruses to be uncovered. Is this a concern?
So it's not the giant viruses we're worried about so much because, like I said, so far the only ones we know about attack amoebas. But, you know, there could be other viruses there. And in fact, you know, a few years ago, people recovered the 1918 flu virus from bodies that were buried in permafrost during the epidemic. And the potential is that there are other viruses that have been, you know, up there for unknown number of years that might start thawing out.
Well, John Timmer, you've introduced us to a whole host of sleeping giants. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
John Timmer, senior science editor at Ars Technica. He wrote about the discovery of the pithovirus, and we have a link to read his article and much more on the giant viruses being discovered at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, an example of what happens when form does not come close to meeting function. A look into one of the most menacing buildings in New York City. That's after the news from NHPR. Heading to family court, chances are it is not by choice or for pleasant circumstances. So you'd think architects might try to soften the imposing nature of a courtroom, maybe make it a little more welcoming, or at least aspire to the Greco-Roman designs that we've grown accustomed to seeing in towns and cities across America. Roman Mars 99% Invisible brings us this story of a family courthouse that looks like it was designed for the Galactic Empire in George Lucas's Star Wars series.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. If you type the word courthouse into a Google image search, you get hundreds of results that look really similar to the U.S. Supreme Court building.
Big steps, a granite Corinthian colonnade, topped by a grand pediment. If the architecture could talk, it would say, respect me. Serious S happens here.
That's Brett Myers. He's reporting this week's show. He went to the New York County Family Court in Lower Manhattan. It's a building that looks nothing like the classic Roman and Greek-inspired architecture that most of us associate with courthouses.
There's little to equate family with the building beyond dysfunction.
If the family court could have talked before its 2006 renovation, it would have said, all who enter are doomed.
Built in 1975, this polished black cubist hulk is about as welcoming as the Death Star.
That's Eugene Patron reading from an article he wrote about his time as a paralegal in the building. He sums up the most common argument about the original design.
The New York County Family Court at 60 Lafayette Street is infamous in architecture circles as an example of form giving not a damn about function.
And that's an easy argument to make.
Absolutely. It filled me with rage the first time I saw this building back in the late 90s. The design just seemed so wrong for a family courthouse. It was like hiring Dick Cheney to be the nanny for your kids.
It was brutalist. Think repetitive angles and thick, heavy forms and lots of concrete. It's a pretty polarizing style, which I actually kind of like.
And before the 2006 remodel, it was possible to appreciate this building, but from afar. Up close was a different story. The shiny black granite panels that covered the whole thing were falling off and threatening to kill people on the ground. It was a looming and menacing building. Even the entrance was scary. There were these huge pylons offset at 45-degree angles, so that when you entered the building, you couldn't actually see what it was you were walking into. It was like stepping into a black hole.
Definitely very bleak and very, oh my God, what is this, a black building, you know? Is this a courthouse?
Miriam Hernandez works there as an interpreter-translator.
It didn't really have the feeling of humanity or humane, you know? It didn't really have that.
What kind of stuff happens inside?
Oh, my God, the question should be, what doesn't happen? What doesn't happen? I mean, it's like you could write maybe a forever book about what takes place inside, you know?
And that forever book wouldn't be a light read. It would have chapters about custody battles and divorces and abuse, children going into family court and their fates being decided behind those doors. If anything, you would hope that the architecture would inspire trust, not fear, and maybe even convey a little bit of warmth. But instead, court employees refer to it as the Darth Vader building.
Luke, your mother and I are getting a divorce.
Pardon me, Lord. The question is, was the form of the New York County Family Courthouse completely antithetical to its function? I met a guy who's got a really interesting theory about this.
This guy goes by the name Lofter One.
My Clark Kent is a basically I do freelance research.
By day, he's a writer-researcher for a real estate blog, but his secret identity is Lofter1. It's the handle he uses when contributing to Wired New York, this hugely popular website about all things New York City. The community section is basically a forum for urban design geeks, and Lofter1 is one of the biggest geeks on the site.
So, how many posts have you posted since June?
Way too many for a sane person. A couple thousand. I'm not sure. No, it's like 28,000, something like that.
28,131 posts.
That's as of when? Because you didn't check this morning, did you? I've added a few.
You've added a few today?
Yeah. I go on there almost every day.
In fact, he averages almost 13 posts per day, and most are related to architecture and urban planning. One of his first posts was about the remodel of the building we're talking about, the family courthouse, the building we're standing in front of.
That old place, I felt like I was kneeling down and crawling through a teeny little hole in a cave.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what the hell. There's a bear, there were bats, there was something on the other side.
What happened inside was not going to be good. They should have put, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Because that's what the message it was sending.
And Lofter 1 argues that that message had a timestamp. That old, black, shiny Death Star of a building reflected the New York of the times, the New York back in the 70s when it was built.
Watergate, financial distress, social divide. It all makes total sense.
Total sense that this building looked the way it did. And this argument gains even more weight when you consider a 1977 story by famed New York Times reporter Laurie Johnston. The article profiles users of the court in what is essentially a critique of the system. She interviews people who spend days shuffling from one waiting room to another, and their critiques of the bureaucracy go hand in hand with critiques of the architecture.
Here's a quote from the 1977 article. "It seems like a maze, this place. Or worse, it seems like it's run like a prison, with uniforms all over. Maybe it's meant to discourage you from going ahead."
It's like, you want form to meet function? This is how this court functions. This is what this court does. It sucks people in and spits them out, and there's no feeling. It doesn't solve the problems.
Now, of course, the courthouse has been remodeled, and it's warmer and friendlier, and it reflects a city that's friendlier and more functional.
The black facade is all gone. It's kind of a light gray now. And the entrance is all opened up. It even has kind of an awning.
That doesn't look imposing or unfriendly at all.
And there's no more threat that those black granite panels are going to fall off the side of the building and kill people.
And oh yeah, it's also kind of boring.
The remodel is definitely a little boring, and it's not a building I want to talk to my friends about. But that original building angered me, and it was something I talked to my friends about. It was dark and interesting.
And now Brett kind of misses the old building.
But I also know that I'm privileged because I don't have to interact with it, because I don't have to work there, and I'm not a kid who has to walk into family court. For them, this milky, bland remodel is a definite improvement.
And probably a sacrifice worth making. Come on, it's for kids, man. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Brett Myers and me, Roman Mars, with support from Lunar, making a difference with creativity. It's a project of KALW Local Public Radio 91.7 in San Francisco, the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. You can find out more at the website. It's 99percentinvisible.org.
Coming up, a singer-songwriter puts a surprisingly optimistic spin on his own divorce. Josh Ritter talks with us about his latest and perhaps most personal album, The Beast in Its Tracks. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a break.
My new lover, sweet and kind, the kind of lover that one rarely finds, and I'm happy for the first time in a long time. Came along and opened up a door.
Word of mouth.
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 From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to the song New Lover by Josh Ritter.
I've got a new lover now,
I know that she's not mine, and I only want to hold her. I don't need to read her mind, and she only looks like you when she's in a certain light. I got a new lover now. She knows just what I need.
And that's from Josh Ritter's latest album, The Beast in Its Tracks. It's a highly personal record chronicling Ritter's life after divorce. It's the type of album you might think would be full of self-pity, bitterness, a little wallowing, maybe a little binge drinking, but it is not. Ritter tackles the difficult topic with graceful, mostly upbeat songs that showcase his humor, his honesty, and his hope that new love will find its way. Josh Ritter is going to be playing at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Friday, March the 28th, and joins us now with more. Josh Ritter, great to speak with you again.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Josh, you released The Beast in Its Tracks about a year ago, but it feels right somehow to be talking to you about it now, because it feels kind of spring-like, you know, new beginnings, letting the season behind stay behind. Is that something you were aware of when writing the record?
I would say that when I first started writing, when I first started searching around for the way to write about songs about this, about getting about a divorce, I was so angry and so worked up. The stuff just didn't have any self-reflection. It was just radiating anger. That's not fun to listen to. It's not fun to write. And it was not. They weren't good songs. And it actually took for me to really start to talk about how I felt, to describe for myself how I felt in a song. And so as time has gone on, certainly the season's changing, and the numerous things in my life that have changed since then. I'm really so happy I caught those feelings when I did, because I certainly can't, that it's harder, thankfully, for me to relate to the person that wrote that than, it's been really nice.
I guess that may be why it's taken 3 years since your last studio album. I guess a little time had to pass.
Yeah, time had to pass, and I've always believed that, you should release a record when you have the stuff you want to say, and I feel like a lot of times it's so easy to release stuff now that, you can release stuff that's substandard, or you can release stuff that's just way too much and be the guy at the party that's talking all the time.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of the song New Lover, one of the most amicable breakup songs I've ever heard, at least until the last line. Let's hear that.
I hope you got a lover now. Hope you got somebody who can give you what you need, like I couldn't seem to do. But if you're sad and you are lonesome and you've got nobody true, I'd be lying if I said that didn't make me happy too. I'd be lying if I said that didn't make me happy too.
Okay, so again, no furniture upended in that song, no binge drinking. Tell me a little bit about writing it, though. At the end, you say, but if you're sad and you're lonesome and you got nobody true, I'd be lying if I said that didn't make me happy, too. I guess we can't totally transcend those feelings.
No, and that's the part that I think is really amazing. One of the things I learned from writing this record, that I really actually learned, was that oftentimes the stuff that is the most interesting is never a single strain of emotion. It's always a number of different currents moving through. If we feel any moment of victory, there's always a moment of there's moments of self-pity. We're humans, and humans are animals, and we living up to those and admitting those conflicting and kind of intertwining strains of human emotion are what makes, I think, writing interesting. And it also makes it, more honest. I love songs that are, Ricky Nelson's song, where it's just pure love, There's a pure love to it. But if you're going to, get into something that's deeper and darker, you have to, start introducing new elements. And I love that about it. New Lover was the first point when I really discovered that I could, wish somebody well and still flip the bird at the same time.
But there's also a lyric that says, she only looks like you when she's in a certain light. And you repeat it other times in the album, so that comes back, but different ways. Was that one of those lines banging around in your head?
Yeah, and in my life, I think you think you've learned a lesson, but you still, you still make the same mistakes over and over. I mean, I think we all do. Eventually, we move on. But like, but I thought that was something I could say definitely about myself, and that line just felt so real that I didn't want to lose it. And I always liked that there's some lines in records that just make their way through and keep happening. You know, they keep popping up, and they kind of give the record a little bit of a reason to be a record, you know, and not just a set of songs.
It's funny, Josh, because I think of your writing as kind of big picture writing. I have spoken with you about the novel that you wrote, Bright's Passage, and that certainly is looking at historical perspective. In other albums, you've explored historical figures and events and avoided that kind of confessional element of writing. And I don't hear confessional here, but it is much more personal. Is that a direction you want to explore more?
I think it's something that I avoided. I really feel that there's far more interesting things to write about, you know, stories and like things where, you know, you could explore, you know, all the things that make a song interesting, the human emotions and the adventure, but it could be about something else besides your current love life, you know. I felt like there's other people that do that so well, and that was not my thing. But I do believe now that wasn't exactly why I wasn't writing about it. I think that I wasn't writing about it because nothing, like, essentially, like, terrible in that way had ever happened to me before. I've been very lucky in my life, you know, and I didn't need to unload all that stuff or figure it out that way. But I feel that when the time comes and things turn around that way, I'm sure that will happen again. But I'll write about something else that's very important to me in that way. But until then, I just really love writing about other stuff, you know.
Singer and songwriter Josh Ritter is with us. He's going to be playing at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Friday, March 28th. Let's hear another song from his latest album, The Beast in Its Tracks. This is called Joy to You, Baby.
There's no ghosts in the graveyard. It's not where they live. They float in between us. What is and what if. And cast our own shadows before our own eyes. You don't get them up here, though. They don't come up high. Joy to the city. The parking lot lights. The lion of evening with the rain in its eyes. Joy to the freeway. Joy to the cars. Joy to you, baby. Wherever you are. Met you, you couldn't have gone, but then I wouldn't have met you, and we couldn't have been. I guess it all adds up. Joy in the end, joy to the city, the heat wave and all.
Just a little bit there from Joy to You, Baby, a song from The Beast in Its Tracks, a new record by Josh Ritter, or the most recent record by Josh Ritter. Josh, you recorded this at the recording studio in rural western Maine. We've spoken to other bands like Lake Street Dive recently who recorded albums there. Now, you're talking about an urban environment here, but it is a kind of lonesome song. Did that isolation of working in Maine make its way onto the album?
I have always, partially by choice, but also by chance, like, have always ended up recording in rural places. As a social thing, it's one of the most fun parts about making music. So you're up there with your friends and you're making something, and it's nice to all be in the same spot and go to bed at the, you know, and then wake up and all be there, you know. And in the city you can kind of just wander off. Also in the city there's so many options, you can do so much, and sometimes having all those ways is detrimental. I think that you get to be really experimental when you're trying to find the right sound with sometimes with like limited ingredients.
Now that you've had a year to reflect on this album, though, and you've played these new songs at shows all over the place, has your relationships to the song changed at all? Is that what happens with them?
I think always it does, you know. But the funny thing is that they still jump up and bite you, you know. Like there's still an excitement every time to playing the songs. I find that, like, you know, as time goes by, the songs seem to have been written by somebody else because it's really true, you know. That like you never remember where you write the song, and you forget about what you were actually thinking when you started, you know. And that's like, it's such a strange thing, and I feel that way, especially with these songs. My life has moved on in so many positive, fantastic ways, and thankfully, the pain there is only on the record, you know, and the joy has continued, which is like really what you would hope.
Well, let's hear another song. This one's called Heart's Ease, because it seems as if you have found that to a degree. Let's hear it.
The high up country is the place where I have always longed to wander wild and free. Among the slender and the peace of mind grow mountainsides of my own heart's ease. I've been with beauties and I've been with some that even speaking of them would be like using the moonlight to describe the sun. The fairest one is my own heart's ease. Deserts and a crested swells, the unknown country and the far-flung isles. The shores are far away and fare thee well. There's nowhere else like my own heart's ease.
It's funny that so many memorable songs are about heartbreak rather than heart's ease.
Yeah.
I wonder what you're thinking about now. What are you currently working on?
I'm writing more songs right now than I've ever written in my life.
Really?
It's just a great time.
What do you think's making that happen?
I'm really happy. I'm really happy, and I have a good relationship with songs right now. You know, I feel like I've got a little older. I have a family. You know, writing songs to me has become this great time when I have to have fun. Otherwise, I'm wasting my time. You know, so the songs are just feeling terrific. I'm working on a record of cowboy songs for Bob Weir, which
Whoa.
Is gonna be really fun.
And Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, yeah, and doing. I'm just getting to do a lot of stuff that I really enjoy. And when I sit down at my desk, it's just easy to like put stuff down and no pressure, you know. Nothing is enormous. It's just about having fun, and the results are really exciting.
Well, Josh, we can't wait to have you in Portsmouth again. Thank you so much.
I can't
for your
wait
time.
For being there. Thank you for having me.
Only in your arms and where.
Josh Ritter will be playing at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Friday, March the 28th. You can find more information on the show and on his new record. Listen to a few tracks at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some of your listening time with us today. If you do like what you heard, there's much more to hear and to pass around at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show today, we discussed a theory that germs may have played a major role in the success and shaping of cultures around the world. In honor of those who have avoided disease, we've compiled a list of the world's most notable and maybe unexpected germophobes, from Howard Hughes to Howard Stern. You'll find the full list on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more radio you'll want to spread around on Word of Mouth. Tomorrow at 2 from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.